Start of interview with V.L. Wirasinghe, 28th of June 1967.
You would say that the process was far too slow. The
process was far too slow. Now, in earlier times, say before independence, and even for some time after.
Yes.
The nature of our duties, say in the civil service, were very different from what our duties became in later years. I would say a government agent, for example, he had certain well-defined functions to perform. It was very little really in the way of development work that he'd have to do, except perhaps in land development, which from about 1935, from Brain's time, had required a certain amount of initiative and push. But in most other departments, it was something very stereotyped. You merely had to observe the rules and carry on. There was not very much initiative and drive required in a civil service job. Whereas since independence, and particularly in more recent times when emphasis was placed on food production, industrial development, those things, I think that by training, the civil service officers particularly were not suited to that. They would have to make a big adjustment.
You have some questions on this, Robert?
Well, I'm interested in this comment because I can show him something I know for. What kind of an adjustment do you think that they had made? Can you explain what would be involved in making this adjustment? I mean, would they have to know, say, less law and more sociology or more agronomy? Is it something like this, sort?
Well, no, of course, the civil servants would be more concerned with the administrative aspects. Now, take, for example, food production. Now, there's a great emphasis placed on food production. Now, if an officer is to make a good job of this food production, he has to travel more in his district. And in Ceylon, this means a great deal of going around on foot in most of our districts. It also means coming into contact very much more with the villagers and being continuously in contact with them, keeping in touch with what is going on in the various villages, from one village to another, keeping in touch with the various village organizations, rural development societies, cultivation committees, and that sort of thing. Now, in earlier days, it was not so very necessary. We got this done by the chief headman. Whatever had to be done, contact with the villagers and so forth, villagers, was made by the divisional revenue officers, the Mundia chief headman, and the other headman and so forth. But under the new dispensation, in order to make a success on this, because the emphasis was now on these matters. In the old days, the emphasis was more on collection of revenue and so forth. You could leave these other matters to DROs and headmen, and you could concentrate on collection of revenue, gun licenses and all that kind of thing. The emphasis now was different. And the civil servants themselves, government agents, assistant government agents and others, would have themselves take an immediate interest in jobs of work which earlier they had left to others. So they would have to take that interest themselves. Now, there are at present a large number of civil servants or people who, members of the administrative service, serving in the provinces as government agents, assistant government agents and their assistants. Now the present Prime Minister has placed emphasis on this food drive. In fact, he had criticized somebody, I think, in Batikolo, government agent Batikolo, for not taking sufficient interest in this. Now, say in the 1930s, the government agent would not have been expected to do this kind of thing. He could have left it to his GROs and all the others, and there wasn't all that emphasis on fruit production in those days. Warriors, yes. It began at that time period. Yes, Robert.
Warriors.
No, I was wondering if there are any more on this line. And of course, that is just one sector, food production. Take things like, say, industrial development. Now, the Department of Commerce and Industries, that really owes its origin to one man who took an interest in these things. It was really outside of the scope of civil service activities at that time. It is Balfour who took an interest in this and started this thing off. And even at that time, he was regarded by most of his colleagues as a bit of a crank and doing something that was not so useful after all. Really, now there is an emphasis on this. But it is not every civil servant who can fit into a job like that.
Well, then what you're saying is having to be done is to change from a law and order, revenue collecting public service to one that's involved in
development,
providing initiative and so on. Well, now what does this mean in terms of the education perhaps that the public servant should have before he enters the public service, the kind of training he should have? How would this differ today than it than what was all right in the past?
Well, for one thing, it seems to me that there has to be much more specialization than there has been in the past. Unfortunately, in my view, the government has taken a wrong step in widening the administrative service, which is really a step in the opposite direction, away from specialization. Because with this administrative service that has been set up, various officers who had specialized in certain fields are being transferred to other fields, merely because in those other fields there are posts which carry higher salaries maybe than in the area in which they are specialized earlier. As an example, say local government service. Now, an officer who was only a few months ago commissioner of local government, having been recruited as a local government service officer into that department and having worked his way up, so all the experience he had gained in the local government service, he's suddenly transferred as a government agent to an entirely different type of job with various other functions to do, where he had to learn up a whole lot of stuff that he had not earlier known, and where his experience in the local government service would be largely wasted.
Apart from that question of training, as you enter the service,
yes.
Have, with this change of emphasis in the nature of government, have they adapted the training to suit the change of emphasis?
No, they have not. Not at any rate at the top administrative levels.
Mm.
It is by sheer accident you may find people in certain posts which they feel very adequately.
Mm.
Take a man like my father. He's quite suited to the job he's holding now as Director of Development in the Ministry of Industries. He understands it. But that's pure accident. I mean, he hasn't had any special training for it. Because lower down you have people who have been in that department a long time, who are not members of the administrative service. They've been a kind of closed service, so they remain there. Now, my Wagenham has come to this particular post from having been controller of imports and exports, which is a totally different kind of thing.
What about the... the question of value of a generalist as against a specialist, say in the position of a permanent secretaryship, or even in charge of a department, as a head of a department. Some people say that a specialist is better, but then others argue that for administrative matters, a generalist would be adequate enough.
What I should think is now, when you speak of a generalist, most members of the, say, administrative service have specialized in some branch. Say, for example, an officer has had, he's a chemistry honors man. Another man may be a physics honors man. Another chap has done economics. So, once they get into the administrative service, they would have to train as administrators. That would give them a kind of general administrative background and training. But having, in addition to that, there are several backgrounds. This chap's a chemist, the other man has done economics, somebody else has done physics, and so on. So it should be possible to fit these people into administrative posts in the appropriate department. You may be wasting a chemist in the treasury, perhaps, if you have some force in some department where chemistry matters.
I think so, yeah.
You can put him there.
What do you think about this claim that people with more specialized training make, that their career prospects are better if they become simply an administrator? Say they are trained in physics or mathematics or something of this sort, perhaps even a postgraduate degree. They get in the public service and they start performing administrative jobs that don't really require the specialized training they have, because they say that they get higher jobs, they get more pay this way.
And if
this is true, yes.
You think that's true?
You think there's been, in other words, some kind of bias in the functioning of the public service against the specialist in favor of the general administrator?
Well, there was in the up to recently there has been a bias. That is because that's largely related to the civil service office. What we call the civil service, because what corresponds to the British administrative service, for example, the highest salaried posts have been in the administrative service. And recruitment to the administrative service, to the civil service, was through examination. And of course, you found classicists, chemists and mathematicians, historians, chaps who've done English honors, they all would compete in the examination, and they would go into this administrative service. Of course, in the past, chaps who got into the administrative service, having qualified in chemistry, for example, they would just have nothing, no more chemistry to do, any more than the classicists would be translating Homer thereafter. So, the justification for this was, of course, that under the British system, British government was interested, their primary interest was in efficient administration, and they wanted to get into it. So whether he had done chemistry or mathematics, if he had this highly trained mind, which enabled him to get through a competitive examination and be elected, well, he was the best man, they thought, to have in the administrative post, because their principal interest was in not in medicine or in industry or something else.
This reflects again this order-preserving type of culture development.
Yes. So, now of course I think the pattern has changed quite a lot. In the old days, the government was the one and only employer. Today, people go into the private sector, for example, where they get paid much higher remuneration than the government. they would go into industry, if industry is in jobs in some sort of available in industry, or they would go and say to Lever Brothers where things might be in demand, and so forth. And also, there are your problem is really with the technical departments of the government. Say, an engineer, for example, a civil engineer. If he goes into the PWD, Public Works Department, how high can he go in for his salary? If a person of equal attainment going into the administrative service would be able to get up to a higher salary than the civil engineer who goes into the PWD, that remains true.
You think that this is a handicap? This is a disadvantage. It's discouraging specialists.
I don't really know. It may be, of course, that while this situation exists, a good engineer, if he can get through the competitive examination into the administrative service, might prefer to go in there. Prefer going in there to doing engineering, and so the engineering might lose. I mean, we are losing an engineer who goes into the administrative service. On the other hand, of course, the top administrative force also require people with brains, and you don't qualify in administration as such in the school. You do subjects, you do English or classics or history or something or other, and then get in there. You might even say that the classics honors man is wasted in the administrative service. You should be in a school. Why don't you pay the school teachers up their salary so that the man goes in there rather than into the administrative service? Because he won't do any more work once he's gone into the administrative service. So, in so far as administrative service also requires caliber, if some engineers do in fact get into the administrative service, I don't think you can complain too much.
Yeah,
but I think the ground of complaint might be that the engineers who do go into engineering and forget about the administrative service, they are not paid enough when they get to the top, as compared with the people in the administrative service.
Mm-hmm. Now we are talking about specialization vis-a-vis recruitment. What about within the service, once you get in? Now you allocating them into a suitable area and keeping them in that area rather than giving them a generalist administrative experience. You know, putting them into one avenue, so some sort of department, say land development department, and keeping them there rather than transferring them here and there.
Yeah.
You think that sort of thing is better?
Well, they would have a basic kind of training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, under British administration, you did have a certain amount of specialization. Now, a new recruit, a cadet, he would do the round of the kutchery, he would get judicial experience, administrative experience, he would go around, and then at a later stage, he would tend to get into particular departments. For example, now, I remember a man like Gibson, for instance, he went into labor and he stuck there. Man like H.E. Jans, he went to land settlement and he stuck there from land settlement officer until he became settlement officer himself. Similarly, C.L. Vikramasinghe, having done the rounds, he went into land commissioner department and he became land commissioner. So it tended at the very last stages, they went into that particular department and stayed there. I should think now take a man like, say, Miles Wagner, who is now in the development department. I think now he's comparatively young. I think he's about 44 or so. I don't think he ought to be ruled out of that place. Now, he has had a general administrative background, training. I don't think he's going to learn very much more about administration by going into land development or going to a country and so forth. I think he has the necessary administrative background to enable him to make a success of the administration required in his own department. And he has the necessary knowledge, the necessary kind of specialist knowledge for the department he's working in at the moment.
Coming back to the earlier point, the question of the politicians' attitude, did you feel that they came in with preconceived opinions and a sort of preconceived bias against the civil service, and that some of their criticisms were unjustified?
As I said, the new lot of politicians, particularly, I wouldn't say the Prime Minister himself, although he was constantly being nudged by these people to make criticism of the administrative service. But most of the other people, particularly the members of Parliament, who were not in the cabinet, they came in with the idea of that the higher civil service were UNP-minded, and that they were going to resist any measures which were of a kind of socialist character. And they had vested interests in which might be jeopardized by this kind of socialist trend. And they came in with that idea, and so they would have liked to see the civil service being abolished or administrative service being introduced to absorb the civil service, which was eventually what happened. Whether their criticism was fair or not, on the other hand, I think on account of the attitudes of these MPs themselves, they came in with the idea that since they were the representatives of the people, the government servants, the public servants, should accede to their wishes and carry out various projects which they favored and so forth. They were not very well acquainted with the procedures laid down to government servants, the restraints that they were under, and also the financial implications of what they wanted done, that something had to be budgeted for before financial provision made before something could be embarked upon. Also, each member of parliament, particularly the new ones, they had often quite well worthwhile schemes so far as the electorate were concerned. They were good schemes, and they felt that, they honestly felt that this ought to be carried out. But it was not always possible, say for the government agent, to get that thing done, because he had to take the needs of his whole district into consideration. He had to establish priorities and work to the money he had. He also had to work within the framework of instructions given by the departments in Colombo. Take a thing like this. Say an irrigation work, and a member of parliament wants, shall we say, a dam constructed across a river, channels provided to irrigate a tract of paddy fields. He would consider this a very deserving piece of work, something that ought to be done, because here he was going to get 100 acres of paddy land irrigated. But that was all he thought. But the government agent, on the other hand, he had to consider, he had to get reports from the experts, from the irrigation officers. What would be the cost of this dam? What would be the cost of the channel? And also of maintaining it from year to year. What would be the extent benefited, and what would it then cost per acre, these works, cost per acre of paddy? If it was going to cost more than, say, 500 rupees per acre, something had been fixed by government, well, he was not to take that up, because there were so many other schemes available where you could have the benefits flowing at less than 500 million. So you had to give priority to those. There wasn't enough money to go around. So it was extremely difficult for the government agent to explain this to the member of parliament. The member of parliament just couldn't or wouldn't understand this, because he had himself to pacify and placate his constituents. So the member of parliament, when there was refusal, he would regard the government agent as being hostile to him. They took a very parochial view of these things, and there was that difficulty with these people.
I was wondering whether, particularly with regard to ministers, when they made these statements criticizing civil service in public, whether they were merely public statements, made in parliament and so on and so forth, but whether after making these statements they came to the office and worked quite comfortably with the civil service.
In most cases, yes. But there were a few cases where ministers got the permanent secretaries transferred and others put in their places, heads of departments transferred, others put in their places.
Mrs. Vijayawardene and Gunaratnam.
Mrs. Vijayawardene and Gunaratnam. There were other cases too.
This matter of, you say, the SOFP came to power in 1956, thinking that the higher public servants were largely sympathetic with the UNP. Do you think this is true? The private political views of the higher public service, do you think they are mostly, and were mostly with the UNP?
I think so, but I wouldn't say that when I say I think so, of course I don't know how they voted or anything like that.
But you'd have some idea of knowing.
Yes. But that was not due to opposition to, say, Mr. Bandaranaike as such. It was largely on a personal basis, I think. Because somehow the UNP, the UNP members have come from a certain stage. They had known that in school they were the same crowd of people who became ministers and so forth. Now Mr. Banda, he was a DRO. All these various other people had been at school with most of the people. So they were on a personal level, they knew these people. Whereas they didn't know most of the SMSP MPs and so forth. And I think it was mainly that, rather than any kind of determined or organized stand against the SLSP.
Do you think when Mrs. Bandaranaike came into power in 1960, this got worse or better? I mean, were by then the people used to each other, both the politicians and the public servants? Or were there, it seemed to me, and there were some public indications of even stronger criticism after 1960 by the politicians. Did you notice any particular change in the relationship?
Of course, the criticism of the civil service became much more acute after Mrs. Bandaranaike came into power. Because I think, in spite of everything that has been said in criticism of Mr. Bandaranaike, he was a restraining influence on the rank and file of the SLSP. Mrs. Bandaranaike herself was out of touch. She did not really know the... She was herself about administrative procedures and so forth. She was not wise to any of that. And she herself would have liked to see much more speedy implementation of her policies and so forth. She was also chafing at the various restrictions in the way of getting things done. And of course, when at her election, I think we had quite a number of new people coming too. And I think is merely an impression that some of the SLFP ministers under Mrs. Bandaranaike started off with the impression that they would have a much greater say in the policy, in policy framing and so forth, than they had had under Mr. Bandaranaike. Actually, it was quite different as things went on. But they thought they could do very much more on their own, and kind of assert themselves more.
I'm afraid I have to call a halt soon because I have a dinner appointment. But a couple of questions. Now, for instance, the SLFP came in with this attitude that people were largely UNP sympathizers, and they were correct. But they made the further step, implied really, that this would bear on their performance, which is a different thing. You can be a UNP sympathizer and yet carry out the orders by virtue of your training, traditions of the service, so on and so forth, of a government you're not in sympathy with. But they didn't, did they understand?
No, I think what happened was, well, I can't scarcely want to mention names, but I'm certain that various ministers of the SLFP government, they wanted to pack their ministries and their departments with people, with officers, who they thought were sympathetic to themselves. And this was intensified when the when after the coalition, the leftist people, the three ministers coming in. Also, they wanted very much to interfere in appointments and disciplinary matters. And much of the trouble as between ministers and permanent secretaries and heads of departments arose from this, because quite a few of the permanent secretaries stood against this. I know from my own experience I have stood against it, and I think I got away with it, but some permanent secretaries gave in to it and did as the minister wanted them to do, or went about halfway towards pleasing them. Although, of course, not very without any enthusiasm. And the ministers were aware that it was not very enthusiastically that they were supporting them, but they had to do it. Others, of course, the minister got their transfer. But others in their place. Because the SLFP minister, right, now, they even, some of them went so far as to say that that our system is no good. This British system of the public, the ministers not being able to make appointments, and permanent secretaries continuing, permanent secretaries should go out with each government. Minister must have, if he is to have his policy carried out, he must have men who are 100% loyal to him and are of the same, hold the same views as he does. Whereas we were saying, well, we are public servants, so the policy making is your affair, so long as it is within the law, within the constitution, we carry it out. Because they were not very happy about it. They wanted what Mr. Bandaranaike himself called was extra loyalty, something positive, positively pro-party. And when they didn't get that, they were not at all happy about it.
Anything more on this theme?
No.
Just one other aspect with about sort of rapport with the people and contact with the religion in particular. Now take the 1900s, Wolff's time. No cars and no jeep in particular. And therefore people officers had to go out in the country, stay overnight quite often. Whereas gradually with coming in of the motor cars and the jeeps and improving communications, and AGA goes to a point, sees to a job, and comes back. How does this bear on the contact between the officer and the people, and also on his knowledge of countryside opinion and countryside needs?
I don't think it makes very much difference. Then and now, I think it depended largely on the individual officer. Because I know I had served under a fair number of European British officers. Now, men like Dyson, for example, was in the north. He was very free and easy with the people. He spoke the language too. Yes, most of the time he would go out in the villages. And the villagers kind of treated him as a friend, and he could very easily approach him and so forth. On the other hand, a man like the government agent was a bedular when I was there. He was virtually unapproachable to anybody.
That's many things.
Then a man like Hudson, for example, in Ambattur, he used to go about and so forth, but he wanted to be very friendly and so forth with the people. He wasn't any conceited or bumptious man. But somehow the people were really afraid of him and wouldn't come up and tell him as they were put to die, sir, for example.
Was he patronizing?
Who?
Hudson.
No, I wouldn't say so. It was merely that he was a little rough exterior and
did you find any problems in the Tamil areas by virtue of the language problem? And it's distinct, say, from serving in Hambantota.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find it more difficult to get to know the needs of the district in Manna and Jaffna?
Well, unfortunately, I did not serve in those areas, in any one of those areas, too long. And when I was in Manna, I was doing mainly judicial work, and so I had very little opportunity of coming into contact with the people in their villages and so on. But I did in Batikalo, which is also a largely Tamil speaking area, where I did plenty of land work. I used to come in touch with them over the land work. And of course the problem there was mainly that of poverty. We were trying to help them with this land.
No, I was wondering about understanding the need. Didn't you have to use an interpreter in those areas, unlike, say, in the Sinhalese area?
Well, by the time I got to Batikalo, I knew my Tamil fairly well. I could converse with these people in Tamil particularly. Sometimes I had to say, well, it is that, or say it more slowly, and I could get it across.
No, I was just thinking that in the Tamil areas, we would be facing the same problems that all the European officers faced wherever they went. In Ceylon, question of language, you know, and a junior officer.
A junior officer would, but of course by the time he'd been here now, a man like Dyson, he could speak his Tamil quite fluently. Hudson, unfortunately, he wasn't much good at his Sinhalese, even, I suppose he must have passed his examination, but wasn't at all fluent. And he had an unfortunate stammer also.
No, I was wondering whether in view of speeding up of everything and this taking present day circumstances, if for instance Wolff was in Hambantota today or even say in the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
whether a young Wolff in Hambantota in the 50s would have been able to get that insight and write the village in the jungle, which he wrote in 1907, based on his experience in 1908.
He would probably not, because for the mere fact that he wouldn't spend so much time in those places. He wouldn't have to spend the night out. He'd come back to Hambantota, he wouldn't know the conditions so well. But that is so. He wouldn't get into the actual way of living of the villager from the inside, he wouldn't know. But for us it's, well, I don't know about the town dweller, but for us it's not so difficult to, although we don't have to spend nights with them in the villages and speaking to the, kind of have grown into the
way of these
people.
Thank you.
End of interview.